Even a person born blind emotes the same way as you or I. It is hardwired into the brain, and the face is the only place in the body where the muscles attach right to the skin.
I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Tightrope Podcast. We tell the stories of people who are defining the future of work. Our guests walk the tightrope away from meaningless toil and towards work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people, and is fun to do, meaningful work. The stories that our guests tell and the insights that they provide will inspire you to connect with work and experiences that stoke your passions and make the world a better place. For the future of work is meaningful work. It is week 8 of sheltering in place, and for many of us, the week included at least one Zoom session per day that connected us with coworkers, prospects, and clients. You already know how hard it is to be face-to-face with somebody, to read their facial expressions, and determine what they are truly thinking and feeling. And you've also discovered how much harder that process is now that our interactions with others take place on Zoom. Our guest this week, Dr. Dan Hill, is here to help. He is a world-recognized expert on facial coding and the author of several books, including Famous Faces Decoded. Dr. Hill explains how we can use facial coding to understand what others are thinking and to use that insight to make our engagements with them more meaningful. We also discuss how Dr. Hill decided to make this study of people the meaningful work of his career. We spoke with Dr. Dan Hill earlier this week over Zoom. Dr. Dan Hill, welcome to the Tightrope.
Well, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us today from 40 degree St. Paul, Minnesota in May.
Someone's got to suffer through it. I guess it's me.
I remember it well from living there. So tell us about your company, Sensory Logic, and what its mission is.
Sure. In 1998, someone I knew at IBM changed my life. They sent over an article from a now deceased Cornell University publication called American Demographics and said that biggest breakthrough that's essentially ever happened in understanding the human psyche was occurring. That thanks to fMRI brain scans, we now knew that about 95% of people's mental activity was not fully conscious. That was the conservative estimation, and that we are largely intuitive, emotional decision makers. I essentially said to myself, bingo, that is so true. We go around lying to ourselves, pretending we're rational decision makers. So I decided to launch a company to really try to, in my mind, humanize business, to bring emotions fully into the equation so we better understand ourselves, we better understand our customers, our colleagues, our personal life, everything that's going on for us.
Now, the fulcrum of that is something called facial coding. What is that and why is it important?
The first facial coder was arguably Leonardo da Vinci. One of the reasons why the Mona Lisa is so great is the guy delved into understanding anatomy. He really wanted to know which facial muscles reveal which emotions. And so you had that wonderful painting, and then you really had to wait several centuries before anyone was nearly as good as da Vinci at this, and that was Charles Darwin. Darwin essentially said to himself, emotions must have an adaptive advantage. We must get some information from them that allows us to survive and thrive. And so Darwin began to explore this fact that various muscle movements, actions on our face, reveal how we're feeling, whether we know it or not. So facial coding is that ability in real time to understand how the other party is feeling. And because emotions are contagious and business is really people to people, it gives you that opportunity to get a much better sense of what's going on in a meeting or anything else in life.
Now, I got conscious of this idea, I think, during the OJ trial because, and I forgot her name, there was a woman who had written a book about reading people. Joellen Demetrius, I believe, was her name. And I think she was hired to basically help pick a jury for that trial. So I got conscious of it then back in the 1990s, but you have actually expanded its application into a lot of different areas like business. Tell us about some of those applications.
Sure. Well, I do have her book on my bookshelf for one thing, and I read it. She's really more looking at body language, which is a great place to start, but there's some limitations to body language. First of all, you can generally tell people are more aggressive, more submissive, more open, but you can't go a whole lot more specific than that. And body language is really affected by gender and by culture. Mm. What I love about facial expressions is that they're universal. Even a person born blind emotes the same way as you or I. It is hardwired into the brain, and the face is the only place in the body where the muscles attach right to the skin. So obviously, when I started Sensory Logic, I could not sit down with Charles Darwin and have a conversation. Fortunately, there's a man named Paul Ekman who's kind of the modern Charles Darwin. So I learned it from Paul, but the shortcoming was Paul was never interested in bringing it outside of the psychiatry fields. So he had no scoring system. He had no norms. He had no way to come up with metrics. And I know in business, people like to have metrics. You can't fix what you can't measure is a really common cliche. So I went through and I looked at these 44 different muscles, these 23 different expressions, and I gave a numeric value to each of those expressions. So yes, I've applied it in market research for more than half the world's top 100 advertisers. I've used it as a pundit for a political campaign since 2004 on the networks, and even worked on the Mexican presidential race in 2012. I've used it in professional sports to help teams with draft choices and trades and team chemistry. The applications are essentially endless. Emotions and dollars are the two currencies in life.
So you had talked about in our pre-interview about focus groups, and I have been behind the glass on a few of those for some major advertisers. And I often felt that without some spiritual guidance, those things can go horribly awry. And we didn't have the benefit of facial coding. Why do you think facial coding has been such a game changer for advertisers trying to find marketing niches for their products?
Well, my father was an executive at 3M in charge of 3M printed post-it notes. And he said, well, I learned a few things from focus groups. Don't get me wrong. He said, but they are so squishy. And an ad agency with a creative brief to defend will turn the findings inside out just to defend what they came up with. Sure. So, you know, if you've never been lied to in life, you know, congratulations. you're either really lucky or you're not paying attention. And so, you know, so often in focus groups, you have a leader. You know, you think you're interviewing 6-8 people. You've really got one person who's going to dominate the dynamics. And so that person raises their hand. What does everyone else do? Raise their hand and say, oh, yeah, I consider buying that product. Well, come on. That's not reality. Most new products fail, for instance. We did a project for Intel, and based on the verbal input and the hand raising and the votes and all of that, supposedly, I think it was 8 out of these 10 products were going to be, you know, great winners. We came back and said, based on the facial coding, actually 2 of them, probably even just 1 of them is going to work. And 1 out of 10 is much more accurate as to what really happens. So you get a lot of fluff. You get a lot of people trying to look smart, play it safe, join with the leader, so on and so forth.
I remember being in an agency and we were representing a product from a Japanese manufacturer, which, Dan, I could best describe as a giant Alka-Seltzer tablet you drop in your bathtub. And the focus group for that was jaw-dropping. You can imagine you're talking to a consumer and you're explaining to them what this thing does. And the facial expressions were priceless. We didn't know what they meant, but they were priceless.
And was this in Japan?
No, it was in the United States, but okay. It was a Japanese mention the name of the company, but it was a Japanese company. And I think if we had the benefit of your scholarship back then, we probably would have been in a better place with the client than we ended up.
One of the best exposés I know for focus groups is a guy published a piece in New York Magazine. He was paying for his rent in Manhattan by going to focus groups and saying he loved everything. And of course, he got quoted in all the reports. The clients in the back room adored him. The moderators couldn't wait to ask him another question and goose the findings along. Finally, he said in one session, he admitted he didn't favor the company and its product because they had operations in South Africa during apartheid. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, he said suddenly no more invites came to go to focus groups. Oh, his income dried up. And that's one of the things I've always been worried about. I mean, at the risk of losing business, I wanted to really protect people's investments. Say, you know, is your product, is your TV spot, whatever, is it going to work? Is it going to get traction on the ground? Because you're going to find out sooner or later. And I'm trying to do you the favor of helping you identify earlier if you've got a problem and maybe how you can fix it.
So let's pivot this conversation and your scholarship to the realm of Zoom. And you and I right now are having a wonderful conversation on Zoom. And by the way, I love the way you dressed your set. It looks very, very nice. So people like us are doing multiple Zoom sessions a day. My wife is in education. She does two a day, usually with her students' families and also with her colleagues. It's a lot. And I have found now we're into week 8 of our stay-at-home order, and we've figured out how to use Zoom pretty well, but we may not be reading facial expressions particularly well. And this is the real estate we're in right now, top to bottom, to fit a screen. So it's hard enough to read people's facial expressions when we're literally face-to-face. What hindrances, Dan, come into play during a Zoom chat?
Yeah, no, we've moved from face-to-face to screen-to-screen for our conversations and our meetings. And it does introduce a couple of problems. One of them is time delay. I remember the most famous thing that ever happened for me, because anytime you're doing things for the networks, you have these time delays. And so someone would ask me a question or show me a piece of video, and I would say something, and we're fighting through these 2 or 3 second delays. Well, one time I'm doing a remote in Cleveland and the monitor goes out. So I have no visuals at all as a facial coder. It's not quite as bad as that in Zoom, but the time delay can really, you know, play with our brain a bit, because we like the interaction. We involve ourselves in mimicry. If we see an expression, we give an expression back. Emotions are also really contagious. So even if we're not professional facial coders, we are incredibly sensitive to that interaction, that interplay. And so bad timing is bad news. The other thing is the distortions that come, because with the bandwidth, no matter how good, inevitably you're going to flatten out some of the expressions. The micro expressions, the really little quick expressions, may not come across on the screen. And yet those can be the most important thing sometimes, because especially if we think we're going to be signaling something negative, and I think we all get a bit more self-conscious on Zoom because we can see ourselves on the screen. So you can already inhibit yourself a bit, but if you're not making the connections, if you're not reading well, you could pull back, you could take less of a risk, and you just don't have as authentic a communication.
You mentioned an interesting term, micro expression. For our audience, what is that?
In 1/6 of a second, roughly speaking, you are going to show the expression, and then you might squelch it. You might suppress it. You might try to go to poker face, but it's those little quick micro tells that can often indicate what is going on for someone. And even normally, just to be, you know, table setting here, a real expression doesn't go on forever. It comes on, it has kind of a peak, and it goes away. It's kind of like a wave breaking on a shore. One of the ways you can always tell that politicians are being phony is that the expression lasts too long. It's not the wave breaking on the shore. It's like you've gone to Montana and it's a butte, and the peak of their expression, the fake smile they plaster on, doesn't go 3 or 4 seconds. It goes 8 seconds, 12 seconds, 16 seconds. No way. That is not realistic.
Hey, you live in Minnesota, and Minnesota nice is not always considered a nice thing. You know, sometimes that expression goes on a little long and you're like, okay, what's going on here?
Oh, absolutely. We are famous for passive aggressive. So the things I look for is, okay, maybe you're smiling, but is there also a little bit of anger there? You know, the eyes are narrowed a bit, the lips pressed together, the corner. Are you smirking? Yeah, what else is going on besides that Minnesota nice smile?
Oh, that is fascinating. So let's get into the benefits of leveraging facial coding. You mentioned that there are 23 facial expressions. That limits the possibilities down that we have to monitor and react to and be proactive with, wouldn't you say?
It does, but it's still a pretty rich set, and it's far beyond body language. It really has 3 different conditions. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing in terms of leveraging facial coding, besides being more visually observant, I mean, the truth of the matter is we're less Sherlock Holmes than we are Watson. And you might remember Sherlock Holmes puts down Watson at one point and says, Watson, you have an instinctive grasp of the obvious. Most of us are a lot closer to Watson. And when I have gone to conferences and spoken and said, okay, there's 7 emotions and what do they mean? And I make it really simple and I show the 7 emotions and I show one word that kind of defines what the emotion is about. To my shock and amazement, even in conferences with learned folks, the average is about 35%. So we really need to be a lot more emotionally literate, and then we need to be a lot more observant. For my book, Famous Faces Decoded, I took 173 celebrities from different walks of life, and I surveyed people, and I said, what do you think are their two most characteristic kind of signature emotions? And the average accuracy was about the same, about 35%. So there's a lot of room for improvement here, a lot of room for improvement.
I want to take you into the realm that I used to work in, which was executive recruitment, headhunting. And oftentimes, I would meet with people face-to-face. Later on, we would do Skype calls because Zoom didn't happen until a few years ago. But I would find that a lot of what you're saying really came into play. I would try to sit back and I would throw out a question and just watch, make my eyes soft and watch. Was I doing the right thing there?
You were. One of my favorite journalists is Joan Didion, and she said her entire strategy was to go off the interview and say almost nothing. And the nervous person she was interviewing would just spill the beans, and she discovered she got a lot better copy than she would have otherwise. Yes, a good interview, I think always, and particularly in that format, is back up, give the person room, see if they can walk the tightrope, see if they can walk in general, what's going to come out from those sessions. That's the really key thing, because in an ambiguous situations like an interview, the face and the inadvertent words are going to reveal a lot more than the canned, you know, one-liners that they have ready for you.
So this is an election year, and I don't want to step on that grenade too much, but there are some important issues going on with people that are running for office at all levels. I mean, everything from a county prosecutor up to president. So as active participants in this process, what do we as voters, but also as influence makers, what should we be doing with our eyes and our ears, I suppose, to a certain extent, as we watch these candidates?
Well, that of course brings up the issue of lying, because politicians are famous for being two-faced. There is no simple answer as to how you spot a liar based on facial coding. There is no one muscle movement that gives it away, because believe me, if it was true, then every politician and every salesperson would head to the Botox Center or the plastic surgeon to have that muscle twitch removed. But there are some things to look for, and it really depends on the person. Someone who's a really smooth, I guess I'll have to say liar, I'll go out of the realm of politics and take Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff did not show fear when he lied. He didn't. Instead, he smirked, almost as if he felt superior to his victims, as if, you know, you really don't deserve the truth if you're so dumb as to imagine you're going to get these great returns year in, year out, no matter what the market is doing. So I do look for a smirk, some sense that they're beyond you, beyond the truth. Yes, they can show fear, but a really common thing that people go to is they get into exaggerated anger. Think of Lance Armstrong. You know, was I doping as a bike rider?
Yes.
No, I wasn't. How dare you challenge me about telling the truth? So that overly aggressive, even beyond Minnesota nice, passive aggressive. Now we're just talking about aggressive.
Right.
No passivity involved. So there are different strategies people go to. A unique one, kind of in an earlier age of politics, Dwight Eisenhower. He actually wanted to be a straight shooter. So when he lied about the U2 incident, for instance, he showed sadness. He was disappointed in himself for lying. So different people go different places. There is no one template, but you have to kind of go through a checklist.
Richard Nixon was interesting. I remember his eyes darting around.
Nixon was not a good liar, but by no means. I mean, he's famous for sweating, including in the Nixon-Kennedy debates, but his eyes would dart around. You know, his mouth would pull wide in fear. I mean, the guy was raised as a Quaker, after all, and I'm sure some part of his being was like, oh my God, I'm not telling the truth. My mom would be so ashamed of me.
You mentioned Madoff, and that one really stung, because I know people who lost money to him. Yeah, I lost a lot of money. And some of them had family members who were CEOs of major corporations who got taken by him. So your point about most of us aren't able to read these visual cues and micro expressions really is true.
Well, and one of the interesting things about Madoff is he smirked, and otherwise he was a cold fish. You know, there is no, you know, absolute one template that you can put down. But certainly one of the things I look for is how much does a person emote? It tends to show that they are motivated, and it can show that they care. Because if you're interacting with someone who really is not emotionally alive and connecting with you and interacting in mimicry of your expressions, then you got someone who you probably really can't rely on as an ally. they're not particularly there for you. So that's something I always look for, because emotion and motivation have the same root word in Latin, to move, to make something happen.
How did Famous Faces Decoded come about? What was the genesis for you writing it?
Well, at this point, I've done the market research for about 20 years. And I said, you know, I got all my norms and so on. You know, what more am I going to do with this? And I said, I'm going to start offering workshops. I'm going to start allowing everyone in their daily lives, including their personal lives, to do this. So I decided just to go ahead and offer up the secret sauce. Because when I learned facial coding from Dr. Ekman, he first gave me this 500-page manual. So I thumbed through it and I could learn the expressions. But I didn't know what emotions they correlated to. And without knowing that, I really had nothing. So I had to go back to Paul and say, but I need the correlations. what am I picking up here? And that's not generally available. And if it is, it's not reliable. And I decided just to do a favor to people, because I think all of us can benefit from emotional intelligence in our careers and in our marriages and personal relationships, playing sports for that matter. I'm a tennis player. I use facial coding to read the opponent across the net and take advantage when I can. So there's lots of ways it could plug in.
So here on The Tightrope, we focus on the quest for meaningful work. Work that is profound, often protects the planet, empowers people, and is fun to do. How did your meaningful work career come about, Dan?
Well, it came about because I really did want to humanize business. When I got into the field, I remember there was someone living in my building who was a consultant, and she said, remember, Dan, now that you're entering the business world, you'll discover that there are only two things. There are opportunities and challenges. There are no problems. I said, what do you mean there are no problems? She said, because that's too real. You can't do that in business. So you speak euphemistically, you ignore things, you avoid things. And one of the things I thought was craziest was how much you avoided emotions. They are so central to who we are as human beings. I don't think you can be fully alive in your job. You can't be a good manager. You can't have good teamwork if you don't acknowledge the fact that emotions are at play here. So that was really the inspiration for me. And then the question was, okay, so emotions matter, great. But how am I going to find some really actionable way to plug this in with a science and a process so that people will take it seriously? Because otherwise, you have another problem in business, which is too often emotions are signalized as being soft, maybe even being female. I have had so many women come up and talk to me afterwards and say, following a speech or a presentation or a project, thank God a guy brought emotions front and forward, because if a woman did it, unfortunately, in this culture still, it may not be looked on in the same way. And I really want all of humanity to get equal play, equal billing, and I want us to be fully alive to our potential. And you got to bring emotions into play to do that.
Well, I've often found that when they're not in play is when things break down.
Oh, absolutely. It's just like, you know, in business, if you don't get the email or the phone call back and you go a week or 2 weeks after, you know, after a connection, you know something's bad. I mean, almost always. When I started my company, I said to my dad, you know, what should I do? What should I look out for? He said, if you have to, always over-communicate as opposed to under-communicate. Stay in contact with people. You cannot be fully in contact if you don't acknowledge and be alive to the role that emotions are playing in that dynamic. I mean, we say trust is the emotion of business. It is. And contempt is its opposite. We talk about customer satisfaction, which is fine. But what about all the negative emotions that create speed bumps for our interactions with customers? What about engagement versus non-engagement? You mentioned being a headhunter, executive searches. One of the really important things about executive searches is how many senior executives are actually burnt out, that are in a later stage of their career, that are looking for a nice soft landing in the last 5 years where they can really cash in. That's why you want to see if the emotions are happening, if they still have a gear, if they're still involved. I basically predicted that Gates was going to step back from Microsoft because I watched a segment out in Silicon Valley, and it was him and Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs' motor was absolutely moving, but Gates' motor wasn't moving as much as I had seen previously. I went, huh, that's kind of strange. And then I think it was less than 5 months later, the announcement came out that he was, you know, basically backing down a bit from Microsoft operations.
And he's probably doing the meaningful work of his life right now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's so commendable, the amount of money he's given to the WHO. I've been watching him on PBS and other places. I mean, he is involved and he is absolutely concerned about the slow pace that America is facing in trying to handle this crisis.
What we're dealing with right now is really interesting. You're mentioning all the things that go into communication, generally speaking.
And I feel like they've all dropped into the washing machine and it's on spin cycle right now. With crisis comes opportunity. And I think a lot of new businesses are going to come into play right now because new needs are surfacing, but also for people, new forms of work and new forms of communication, I think, are surfacing. How do you feel about that? Do you agree with that notion?
I do. I mean, when I came across the importance of emotions, thanks to that Cornell University piece, I said, how cool is this? I got to explore this. I don't know if I can make a living from it, but how can I resist? Because it's just so emotionally meaningful work to do. But at the same time, I said to myself, reality check, Dan, no one is going to say to you, oh, yes, I can't wait to use facial coding. Nobody knew what it was. Nobody was really paying attention to emotions. I decided it was just a good time to take a chance and step out because I thought I didn't have any other options if this is really what I wanted to pursue. I think a lot of people are going to have that same situation with 30 million people unemployed, dropping out of companies. Are they going to find another job very readily? Some of them may, you know, in time here, but a number of people, especially people in later stages of their career, may not find that someone wants to take on a 50-year-old, a 55-year-old, even a 60-year-old, for instance. It might be the time to say, let me dig in, let me find my niche, let me come up with something inventive and push forward. Fear is obviously got its downsides, but fear can also be incredibly motivating. I mentioned earlier, I'm a tennis player. Mm-hmm. Well, Boris Becker once said, I don't remember a single point I won at Wimbledon. I only remember the fear of losing the match. And so that's the power of fear sometimes. It makes you really alert and it gets your motor going because you sense danger.
Dr. Dan Hill, you are an absolute joy and we want to get you back on the tightrope in the future to talk about some other things. But in the meantime, for our listeners who want to learn more about you and your books and your firm, Sensory Logic, where on social media would you point them?
Well, first of all, I have a blog called Faces of the Week. I try to look at what's in the headlines and think of some angles to take, and there's always a visual that I've decoded. So that is at emotionswizard.com, emotionswizard.com. You'll see to the far right there, if you subscribe, 5 of my most recent books are listed. So that's a good resource. If you want to go into my website at sensorylogic.com, as in your 5 senses, you will see podcast interviews that I have done. You'll see articles I've written, speeches I've delivered internationally over the years. So there are additional resources there as well.
One last question. Do you think the Twins will take the field this year?
My dad is a big baseball fan, and I was going to joke to him the other day, well, you know, they're off to a perfect season. They haven't lost yet.
Yeah.
But I don't think he would take the joke very well. He loves baseball and watches every game. The Twins, many years, managed to make more out of themselves than they should just by being, you know, very conscientious, hardworking Minnesotans. But I don't know. Every time they have to go to New York and try to win a series in New York, it never happens. The big cities just seems to overwhelm them. So maybe, but grew up in Minnesota and having gone through 4 Viking Super Bowl losses, I guess I approach all major sports opportunities with a degree of trepidation.
You know, in 1987, I was still living in the Twins and I got to meet Kirby Puckett. Oh my God, what a thrill that was. And what a great season that was. Although being in the Metrodome, which doesn't exist anymore because that's where they played their games indoors, I attribute my early onset hearing loss to that season.
It was very loud in there. But Kirby, yes, Kirby had the most wonderful infectious smile. I mean, a true smile is when the muscle around the eye tightens, you get the twinkle in the eye. And Kirby could have a great true smile when the occasion fit.
So we'll end on that note. Dr. Dan Hill, thank you so much for walking the tightrope.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Links to Dr. Dan Hill's social media are provided in the show notes for this episode at dansmullen.com. Please join us again for more inspiring stories from people who walk the tightrope to seek and do meaningful work. You can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts, or listen to current and past episodes on our website at dansmullen.com. I'm Dan Smullen, and this is the Tightrope Podcast. Together, let's walk the tightrope to find and do meaningful work, for the future of work is meaningful work. And do remember this, our best days lie ahead. Let's connect again next week.